You're listening to Dig Deep, whether it's in our podcast or on air. I'm Heidi Holton with Aaron Brown and Chuck Marone. We are talking about things that work in our communities, how they work, how they could work better. And Electoral College is the topic of this segment. Chuck Marone, we want you to begin this conversation.
Yeah, I picked this one. I actually came, you know, with a mindset this week that we would talk about some things that are working. And, you know, I wanted to pick one that maybe would go counter to the popular narrative.
And, literally
the popular narrative. And I want to talk about the Electoral College. It's interesting. Do you know how many times the president has lost the popular vote but won the Electoral
Four
College?
Four times.
It's actually five times.
Five if you count Jefferson.
Not Jefferson. The first one was John Quincy Adams.
Okay.
Lost the popular vote to Andrew Jackson and then was named president by the Electoral College.
Mm-hmm.
The subsequent election to that, Jackson clobbered him in both. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Quincy Adams became the second one-term president after his father was the first one-term president. Then you have Rutherford B. Hayes lost to Samuel Tilden.
Or Samuel Tilden got more votes than Rutherford B. Hayes.
Right, but Rutherford B. Hayes won the... I grew up having watched the Disney musical, the one and only genuine original family band. I don't know if you saw that one as a kid. I was like so... I loved like Disney musicals and watched this one many times. The center of the story revolved around this family, but the backdrop of it was the election between Benjamin Harrison and Grover Cleveland. I can't remember. I think it was Harrison now that won or lost the popular vote and won the Electoral College. Cleveland came back the next election and won then both. And then, of course, we have Gore, Bush, and the latest Trump-Clinton, where this happens five times. And it's fascinating to me because I have a lot of urban friends who are just apoplectic about the Electoral College. It's this old antiquated system. They have these, you know, visions of the old white men with the cigars sitting in the smoke-filled room deciding who's going to be president, as if like that's how it really happens. They call it undemocratic. It's un-American. I think it's really important for us to understand a little bit about our founding and the way that our government is set up. Because we say that the Electoral College is undemocratic, and of course, it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so is our government. Our government is not a democratic government in the sense that we have majority rule. There's one thing that I want to set up, and then hand it off to Aaron to kind of beat me up on this.
Yeah, I'm waiting.
It's fine. If you go back and look at the debates early on in this country, after we got through with the Articles of Confederacy and we're drawing up the Constitution, saying, how is this republic going to work? The debate was really on, are we going to have power centered in the states? Are we going to have power centered in the federal government? And when we decided that we were going to have a federal government that functioned, that debate morphed into, should that representation be based on states being represented, or should it be based on population being represented? Which one? And what did we decide? We decided both. We decided, like, we can't decide. Like, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. So if we go based on population, what you have is you have the big population centers dominating the conversation. The rest of the country is ignored. If you go by states, what happens is that small states have a disproportionate representation of power. Large states do not. And that's not fair either. So what we did is we said we're going to have the House represented by population. We're going to have the Senate represented by states. And that essentially is going to balance out this dispute. In order for legislation to pass, it's essentially got to meet both tests. It's got to be a populous states. It's got to meet the Senate and basically equal representation amongst, you know, each different state. What did we do with the president then? We basically split the baby and we said, we're going to try to approximate both. And really, for the most part, it works pretty well. There have been instances where, and we listed five of them, and they were all relatively close elections. I actually think the last one that we just got done with, Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, was the widest margin of victory in the popular vote. But if you look at, if you take out California, it's hardly a victory at all. What you have is you have America changing. And you have the Electoral College is going to be redistributed in 2020. You have this very high concentration of people moving to major urban areas. And you have this shift. And this is the kind of thing that happens in those shifts. I am sympathetic to people who would like what they see as their Democratic preference expressed in the Electoral College. But I think if we step back and understand kind of the tempering device of it, I don't think it's a bad compromise between two different ways of viewing the country. One, what the founding fathers would call mob rule, what people would call democracy, majority vote. And another one, an attempt at a more proportionate representation between different interests spread across a country that occupies the breadth of an entire continent.
Okay. So here is my response.
You gave me, people listening can't see the look you just gave me, which is, okay, I feel sorry for you, poor man.
No. I find myself in disagreement with Chuck. And it comes down to, let me begin by saying the response to situations where we have the Electoral College going a different direction than the popular vote. For me, as someone who is, granted, I come from the side that lost both of those recent elections, whether it was Gore in 2000 or Clinton in 2016, it bothers me that we have a big modern democracy or Republican democracy that has a president who did not have the popular support, or at least the most votes, because we've had a number of elections where someone didn't have a majority and still won half of them, I think.
Right.
Where they win the Electoral College and the popular vote, but they only got like 40-some% of the vote. That's very typical, actually. But in the original concept of the Constitution, we have three branches of government. We have the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. Each has their part to play. And while executive power has changed over the year, becoming far stronger than it once was, the executive was, they actually perceived the president as a figurehead of the nation when they first conceived of the Constitution. They wanted to control the president's powers, but they did perceive him as him or her as the military commander, as the person who would okay what Congress decided to do, and there would be a checks and balances, and the judicial branch would kind of oversee and apply the Constitution to the different things the president and the Congress would do.
The president was the presider.
The presider. That's why they gave him that name.
Right.
All right. So I find the argument that they were really, really precisely concerned about balancing the interests of those who benefit from the Electoral College with the interests of those who benefit from the popular vote to be a little off. And here's why. The whole point of the Electoral College, because at early in the Republic, 1797, I think, 1801, when you had the very earliest contested election between Adams and Jefferson, we've talked about the Federalists and the Jeffersons, Republican Democrats or Democratic Republicans. In that earliest kind of nascent battle, you had several proposals to amend the Constitution to go off of the popular vote. Always they lost. Always they lost because of the power of the slaveholding states, who in a popular system would have lost the ability to preserve slavery. Now, that is ripped out of the debate of the time. And in fact, from the time the Constitution takes effect, for the first 36 years, 32 of those years, we have a president who is a slaveholding Virginian. And Virginia is the state at the time that benefited the most from this because they had a huge slave population that couldn't vote. And they got to, through the Constitution, through the 3/5 provision in the Constitution, count them in the census, which means that the white landowners got to elect their representatives as though the African American people they enslaved were part of their district, even though they couldn't vote and weren't actually represented by that person. So I view that as part of the original sin of the whole dang system. And I don't feel any kind of sacred charity for this way of thinking at that time. Now, right now, when you bring it up, right now, 2018, people talk about it in terms of the urban and rural divide. You know, the big city, we don't want the big cities where all those people live to have all this power over the small states and rural places that have far fewer people, and their issues are important too. And I agree with that basic concept. But there again, back at the beginning of the Republic, the rural people, and it was a rural time. It was the rural-urban split at that time, at the beginning of the United States of America, the rural people were the majority. Cities were a smaller part of the share, whereas now, and in fact, we're tracing towards having two-thirds of the country living in a metropolitan area in not too long from now. The time it was very different. And so at the time, like Chuck said, they wanted to control the impulses of the mob. And they were talking about rural people who weren't educated. And it was more about resting these electoral votes in a controllable environment whereby the state, through its powers of the legislature, which was already electing the senators, we'll talk about that later, through the powers to set election laws and everything else, were controlling this electoral college, which was like a backstop for the aristocracy of the country. And so if you can argue for me that it's good to have a system where a person who wins most of the votes or more of the votes than any other candidate is not elected president of the United States, and it's good that because 10,000 people in Wisconsin voted one way instead of the other way. By the way, we tend to notice the ones where they split, and like the Tildens and the Gores and the Clintons of the world miss out and they don't get to be president. But there have been a number of cases where, like five or six cases, where presidents were elected who were like 2,000 votes away from not getting elected. So it's close a lot more than you think. Gerald Ford could have won a second term. Kennedy easily could have lost to Nixon in a few different ways. So there's a number of cases where this is actually a bigger problem than we would notice.
Let's dispense with the nostalgia about the founding fathers. That was never part of my argument.
Oh, and I'm not pinning that. Saying, like, it's not a sacred system.
No, I'm not suggesting it's a sacred system. I am suggesting, though, that at the time, yes, there were, you know, slave-owning Virginians, there were Northern abolitionists, there were all these different the thing is that there were deeply contentious issues, just like there are today, and they could not resolve them. That there was not a clear, like, one side or the other approach that was absolutely right in all instances. And so what they did is they said, here's the best approximation of the two. Here's the best approximation that we can do. And everybody essentially, not everybody totally agreed with it, but they said, we can live with this compromise. And I think as a compromise has generally served us well. If we get into the partisan nature of it, I remember when Bill Clinton was elected with a plurality.
43%.
And, Twice, actually.
Never did have a majority.
He never had a majority. And what you heard at the time from the left in this country was that, isn't the Electoral College a great thing? It magnifies the winner and gives them a mandate to govern, where if we didn't have the Electoral College, they wouldn't even got 50% of the vote. And you could have listened to, you know, Rush Limbaugh at the time. I may have listened to him in the 90s at times. And he said, you know, this is an illegitimate president, never got a majority of the vote. So these things, like, swing back and forth from a partisan standpoint.
I don't view, though, that Democrats were out there like, yay, electoral college. I think that somebody had to win those elections, and Bill Clinton got the most votes. And so that's why maybe it wasn't made as big a deal as some of these ones where it went the other way.
Right. But he never won the majority of the vote.
And no.
The argument at the time was, you know, look, he won a far majority of the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. He won 60% of the Electoral College. This gives him a real governing mandate because he represents the whole country. Regardless, I do think that what the functioning in today, in 2016 and 2020 of the Electoral College is, it does, for better or for worse, it does require candidates to pay attention to flyover country. If Hillary Clinton, and I think this is broadly accepted, if Hillary Clinton had not relied on her computer algorithms, but instead had gone to Wisconsin and actually talked to some Wisconsin voters, she would be president right now. And, you know, you can't make that case that without the Electoral College that any candidate would ever go to Wisconsin or Minnesota or Duluth. Yeah,
I disagree with that, though, because what if a presidential candidate, both sides, had to spend some time in the three most populous states in the country, Texas, California, and New York, places that candidates never visit now because they're perceived as locked up and unavailable to all but their chosen party, Texas being the Republican state and California and New York being the Democratic states.
Right. And I think it's very hard to argue.
That's a vast part of the country, though.
Right. And I think it's very hard to argue that the concerns and the issues important to Californians, New Yorkers, and Texans are somehow being overlooked in our electoral process. They are front and center of every debate. What is being overlooked, and I think what is continually overlooked, it is the rural Minnesota. It is the district we're sitting in right now. Is Wisconsin, is the flyover country. The electoral system, the electoral college system is not perfect. And I'm not pretending that, you know, it is the ideal representation of the will of the people, but neither is a true popular vote. In a country this size, this large, this diverse, with this many different constituencies, the idea that you would just have one popular vote of the people be, you know, the will in basically like the where we have centralized so much power, I find that a little bit unnerving.
I'm going to posit a potential compromise.
Okay.
And we'll see if we can reach at least an understanding. What if we kept the Electoral College but added a provision that a candidate who wins a majority of the vote across the country shall automatically be deemed the winner? A majority of all votes cast. A majority, not a plurality.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have not really thought about that. I guess out of respect for you, I won't reject it out of hand. I get the reason for that. I think part of, let me say that I will consider that.
Okay.
The part of, and I think obviously we have trouble when we get into Trump-Clinton. We have trouble when we get into Bush-Gore.
And that wouldn't have changed either of those elections, by the way, because neither Hillary Clinton nor Al Gore got all the way to 50%. Maybe Al Gore did.
Oh, I think Hillary Clinton did. Did
she was
not?
49 point.
Oh, really?
Change.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she was very close.
I was going to, let's assume that she did. I think you can make the case for your point of view in that. I think that what this system today forces us to do is to do what we've done for the last year, which is to go back and say, what are we overlooking? What are we not seeing? You see newsrooms across the country questioning themselves, you know, why have we ignored this part of the country for so long? You see all this angst and anxiety about the opioid epidemic and all these things that are very flyover country kind of issues, now all of a sudden are not able to be kind of pushed to the sidelines. And maybe this isn't the healthiest way to get to it, but in a pure like democracy, I don't know how you avoid a situation where you just ignore those things. I think the Electoral College forces us to have conversations we otherwise wouldn't.
Maybe, but I still see, you know, Congress and the proportional representation that gives, you know, with the Senate having two votes, even if you're North Dakota, and the House of Representatives giving it proportionally, favoring the more populous areas. I think that's our balance, though.
Then we're going to talk, and I know I want to talk about this in our podcast extra this week. We're going to talk about direct election of senators, because I think maybe we could reach
but
an
it's
agreement.
It's going to be so sexy and amazing.
I think we could reach an agreement on the Electoral College if we could reach an agreement on the direct election of senators. So
it's Chuck Marone from Strong Towns, Aaron Brown from Minnesota Brown. It's Dig Deep.